The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Study from the Pew Research Center finds many American teenagers, they admit to using social media pretty much all the time.
Yeah,
no surprise.
And it's not a surprise. But despite new attention to TikTok and its impact on children, data is showing that it's not even the most popular social media platform among teens right now.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, we got a lot to talk about. Good afternoon. It is good to be with you today. Thanks so much for joining me and hanging out. I'll give you a little bit more on that story coming up. Also, grab a pen and paper. I'll tell you how to get a plenary indulgence. You may not know what a plenary indulgence is. I'll also explain that to you. I take for granted everybody knows this stuff. You know, as Catholics, we've got an interesting lingo, don't we? Words like transubstantiation. That's a big one, right? I mean, hypostatic union. Throw out some of these words, people say, what are you talking about? But I want to talk about indulgences. People have a lot of confusion over that with Martin Luther and a whole litany of other things. Coming up, you can get one, though. Began on December 8th, runs all the way into February, and I'll fill you in on a very simple way that over the holidays, the church has made this available to you. But before we do, calling you once again, let's pray for priests. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is back in the U.S. He went to D.C. this week. He's got his hand outstretched for some more U.S. taxpayer money. And Congress is considering a bill that would give $60 billion to Ukraine to aid it in its fight against Russia, $14 billion to Israel for its fight against Hamas, plus money for Taiwan. There's also a provision in there that would provide money for more security on the U.S. southern border. That would be good, right? Has anybody seen any of that video? Have you seen any of the footage on the southern border? Oh, my golly, it's crazy. There's a hole in our southern border. I mean, there are caravans of people just streaming across. I heard Mary Graham in our newscast. I don't know if you caught that or not. She was talking about how many different people have, we're not talking Venezuela. We're not just talking Central America. We're not just talking Mexico. I mean, we're talking third world nations and enemy states that are coming across the border. And I often quote that number of 1.2 million gotaways. A lot of people who we don't know where they are or what their intentions were. And if you are a gotaway, give me some instant pause. Maggie, did you say we have audio from Fox News on the border crossing? Well, J.D. Vance, yes. Maggie and I were having a conversation a little bit earlier about the Ukrainian situation. And again, we're talking about closing out the border, but we're also aiding Israel in its fight against a terrorist organization, Hamas. And of course, we've got this situation with Ukraine. And people are torn over whether or not to continue to fund the Ukrainian war. A lot of people are saying we need to do that. I mean, Vladimir Putin has already come in. He's taken major territory. There's a lot of confusion over leadership in Ukraine. Some people really want to push. They want Crimea back. They want it all back. So what is their game plan? I heard this comment a little bit earlier. Check this out.
It's utterly disgraceful. We're about to go through the United States Senate tomorrow, a very undignified process where Zelensky comes to town and demands that you give him, the American taxpayer gives him another $61 billion. And oh, by the way, if you want to secure your border first, you are actually a Putin puppet. He said this publicly today. I think it's disgraceful. I think it's grotesque. And I think that it comes at a time, Laura, when Republicans are actually showing some unity and some courage about the importance of the American southern border. So this is purely designed to apply pressure on Republicans to give up their fight on the border and write another blank check to Ukraine. I'm not doing it. I don't think Republicans should go for it at all.
It was, of course, J.D. Vance, and I think he was talking to Laura Ingraham there. He's a Republican, and he's actually from Rhode Island, but Ohio. I was sick of that train accident there with him and what he had to say. J.D. Vance is the voice of other Republicans in some respects. And, I'm kind of torn on this issue. I don't want to see. I think it's terrible that a sovereign nation can be rolled over by a more powerful nation and their land taken away from them and their country turned to rubble, right? But Republicans have voted against the bill because they say, look, hold on. We've given enough money to Ukraine already and that we need to pay more attention to security at home. My thought is, does it have to be an either or? I mean, can we do both? Can we afford to do both? I'm total alignment on security on our southern border. I am very concerned that in the future, you and I are going to be talking about something that has happened on the inside of this country, something we never thought would happen, right? Zelensky said yesterday that anyone who doesn't vote in favor of the bill, well, they're basically aligned with President Vladimir Putin. I don't think that's a fair characterization. But boy, we've invested so much money right now. One of the comments I heard, I think it was Vance who said it, it might have been somebody else who I was listening to this morning, said that we're not giving them enough money. If we would give them enough money, right now we're just kind of a stalemate. Ukraine could really push back and reclaim its borders. But we'll see what happens. If the bill doesn't, you know, well, let me phrase it this way. Let's assume the bill clears the Senate, right? Let's say it does get through there. It's not likely to make it through the Republican-controlled House. So I'll continue to follow the story for you. I do want to dive into it in greater detail because it's an important issue. You know, the worst thing that ever happened to Ukraine, in addition to Russia rolling in, right? The Hamas, that was the worst thing that ever happened to them. The whole world was focused on Ukraine. And now what's happening? Well, all this money's going to Israel and its war against Hamas. So, and as a result of it, we're talking tens of billions of dollars being spent. Hundreds of billions probably by the time this is all done. So anyway, I heard a piece of audio in the very beginning here about TikTok. And I want to circle back to that because I think this is really an interesting story. There was a new Pew Center research study that shows what a lot of people have come to believe, right? Take a look at your own family or your grandkids or your nieces and nephews, right? Are they always on their social media? Are they always on their phones? Are they always checking their, you know, their Instagram, their TikTok, whatever it be? Pew says yes. There's a new study that has come out and says they have found that teens are on social media almost constantly. And you know what? It's an addiction. It really is. Axios was reporting that the survey of more than 1,400 kids between the ages of 13 and 17 found that anywhere from 14 to 17% of them are on YouTube, TikTok, or Snapchat almost constantly. And they said that roughly 9 in 10 use YouTube, making it far more popular as a social media channel for teens. 7 out of 10 use it at least once a day, if not more. And most teens use TikTok, Snapchat, and Instagram. But their use of Facebook and Twitter, of course, is declining. These things come and go, don't they? It's pretty crazy. News Nation took a look at this. Let me share with you what they were reporting.
The report surveyed nearly 1,500 teens and found that 93% use YouTube, while 63% use TikTok, 60% use Snapchat, and 59% use Instagram. The report also demonstrated a decline in the use of Facebook and X, also formerly known as Twitter. Now, this is interesting. In terms of gender differences, teenage girls are more likely to use Instagram, TikTok, and Snapchat, while boys are more likely to use YouTube, X, and Reddit. The report also comes amid several pending lawsuits filed against social media companies accusing them of endangering young users. In fact, just last week, New Mexico's attorney general filed a lawsuit alleging social media giant Meta of creating a breeding ground that is conducive to child predators. Meta has refuted the allegations and has emphasized it has implemented policies and practices that safeguard young users.
Maggie, that's an interesting stat, isn't it? I mean, the boys would rather use Twitter or X.
Or YouTube.
YouTube or Reddit. And the girls want Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok. Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I think boys and girls are definitely wired differently. And girls might be just looking for communication, yeah, communion with people. I think guys are looking for like a challenge. They're looking for like information. They're looking for like maybe, you know, an argument. I don't know.
You know what surprised me about it though? I mean, guys are so visual. And maybe that's not fair, but I mean, guys are very visual. And I would think, oh, something like Instagram or TikTok or something like that, you could see. But I think your point is right. I mean, Reddit and X are very different in terms of what they deliver over social media.
It's almost
than those
like
platforms.
like a virtual tumbling ground for guys to just kind of spar.
Yeah, it's true.
You know what I mean?
That's really true. That is, yeah, it's an interesting study there. You know, what I find fascinating, though, and I'm very concerned about social media. If I was raising my kids today, I certainly wouldn't have given my kids cell phones. You know, I would certainly be careful about their exposure to it. We know. I've talked about this to you so many times. about the connection with anxiety and depression and all the other problems that, they have, you know, personal perspective. All that social media time is not helping these kids think any better. That's for sure. Neither is public education. Jason Rantz, I don't know if you know that name. He's a radio host on a station in Seattle. It's KTTH, right? He said, I heard him mention that a woman wrote to him in frustration because her son took a quiz, right? There was an answer on, this quiz, and it got marked wrong. You know what it was? It's crazy. Basic biology question, by the way. Doesn't take a whole lot of education to get this one right, but it was true or false questions, and it was asked about male anatomy. And he answered it correctly, but it was marked wrong. And the other question stated that only a woman can get pregnant, which he marked as true. But that answer was also marked wrong. So I'm taking this test, and I say, is true or false, only a woman can get pregnant. And I hit X or yep, check mark, true. And wrong. I mean, you wonder, you worry about social media, I worry about what we're teaching our kids in school. That is malformation. That is malformation. You know, and you talk about misinformation, that is misinformation, right? Shame on them. That's probably people should be fired. I mean, that to me, that's intellectual abuse. Here's a little bit more. Maggie, this comes from what, News Nation? Here's just another report on it. Check this out.
Ms. Soder, Maryland, can men get pregnant?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
And against a woman who is pregnant. That's in the bill. Not people, woman.
Women.
So I would like you to explain, what in your definition, what a woman is.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
There are people who identify
women
as different genders who are capable of getting pregnant. That is my position on this. I am not going to feed more into the bigotry of that question.
Listen to the insanity there, right? And I don't know what that source is. It sounds like it was a congressional hearing of some sort. I am not going to feed into the bigotry. Bigotry? How is being honest about one's gender bigotry? There are certain objective truths in life, right? How are you bigoted for acknowledging those truths, right? I mean, that's ridiculous. There was a Seattle public school spokesperson who I guess told told Rantz. He said this, and I'll quote him: "said Seattle Public Schools, Seattle Public School is dedicated to establishing inclusive environments that allow the exploration of contemporary issues, specifically examining the impact of power systems such as racism and patriarchy." And of course, that doesn't answer why a world history class is teaching biology and, you know, why the correct answer is marked wrong on something so ridiculous. You know what it is? I'll tell you exactly what it is. I'll explain why you have a world history class teaching biology and why that answer was wrong. One word begins with an I, ends with an N, indoctrination, right? That's what it is, indoctrination. They're indoctrinating your kids. Man, I am so glad my kids are not in grade school or high school today or college. I would be scared to death. That is not a good thing. One final story here, too, and Father Tab Holchek's going to come by this afternoon. I want to talk about where we're heading in the world of science. There are some unbelievable developments. The Government Accountability Office was reporting that nearly $2 billion of your money, of our taxpayer money, guess where it went? I've always heard the number $530 million, right? $2 billion went to Planned Parenthood. I'm telling you right now, this country deserves God's justice. When we fund a culture of death, $2 billion. Maggie's asking me, is that a B? Yes. You know, the number they used to throw out all the time, your taxpayer dollars are about $530 billion, a little bit over half a billion dollars. $2 billion, the Government Accountability Office is reporting. And other abortion groups were also given some of that money over a three-year period. So the Daily Wire reported that Planned Parenthood received the lion's share of the money, a whopping $1.8 billion during the three-year period, all while performed, listen to this number, more than a million abortions. You talk about a war? Can you imagine? You know, 9/11 was terrible. You know, we lost 2,000-3,000 Americans, right? We lose that every day in the womb. We got a 9/11 in the womb every day. Could you imagine if a million Americans, somebody set off a bomb and took out a city of a million? Well, that's what Planned Parenthood did. More than a million abortions. Senator Marsha Blackburn, she's from Tennessee, she said $90 million of those dollars were from the Paycheck Protection Program. Shame on this administration. I'm sorry. Just shame on this administration. That is just downright wrong. Again, of course, it started under Trump. I can hear some people say, oh, that was under Trump, right? The Paycheck Protection Program during COVID was to keep small businesses afloat. If you had a few employees, you couldn't make it. It was there to help you, not to kill children, not to kill the future buying base, the future employees, the future consumers. $2 billion of our taxpayer dollars went to Planned Parenthood. Why isn't there more of an outcry on this? I'll tell you what, there's consequence for sin. There's consequence for sin. You know, Senator Blackburn, she noted that the majority of Americans, they don't want their money going to taxpayer-funded abortions. They don't want it. I know I don't. I wish there was a caveat, a line item where I could say no. You know, we work hard. And our money ends up going out to kill children. It's a real, real tragedy. You know, life is under attack, and we've got new moral challenges coming our way, too. I want to bring Father Tad Poholchek, who's been a longtime friend of this show, into the conversation. He's a senior ethicist at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, and he's the author of a column called Making Sense Out of Bioethics, and appears in a lot of diocesan papers around the country. But you can follow him at his website, fathertad.com. And I came across a story that we have talked about in the past with him a little bit. It's going to change the future. You look at how science can help cure diseases, right? And that's exciting. Well, the never-ending search for curing disease now is turned towards genetic modification. And for some diseases, that can be, you know, it can be done through a new technology called CRISPR. And this is a technology where scientists have been able to modify genes to change cells and to make them into platelets again. And it sounds great, but there's a cost. I mean, literally, there's a lot of costs. There's $2.2 million. But and by the way, it doesn't include the months-long stay in the hospital to carry out things like this. You know, includes chemotherapy to kill the patient's immune system so that the body accepts the new genes. But we've talked about the perils of this as well. There was a news headline that came out, and I'll get right into it with Father Tad, because it grabbed my attention. It said this. Let me see if I can find it. Where did it go? Oh, it says this. First therapy using CRISPR technology to treat sickle cell disease. Sounds great. Hey, Father, good afternoon. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Drew. Thanks for having me on.
It's a great headline, right? We got sickle cell anemia, of course, a terrible disease for predominantly the African-American community. But now we have the ability to maybe eradicate it. Fill us in on what's happening. Also, unpack for us the dangerous territory we're entering into if we begin to use this CRISPR technology, but it's not used in a proper fashion.
Yeah, well, I think this represents an instance of proper use of it, potentially. You're right, it's very expensive. That's going to be a limitation. But basically what you have is a situation in sickle cell anemia where your red blood cells don't form correctly because you have a defective form of something called beta globin. And it's basically you have one bad segment of DNA and it twists the shape of these proteins inside your red blood cells and makes the red blood cell go from being nice and round to being kind of sickle shaped. And those get stuck in your small blood vessels. And that means that you don't get oxygen to your organs. And what happens for these patients with the passage of time, they have these sort of attacks of pain episodes that can be pretty severe. And so sometimes you can do things like blood transfusions, which will give you, you know, better ability to carry oxygen and some other temporary sorts of fixes. But this approach that you and I are talking about today, which uses CRISPR, offers a whole different way to go about it. And what it basically does, to put it in the simplest terms, it reactivates a kind of nascent or hidden form of hemoglobin that we all produce when we are little babies. When we're in the womb and when we're newborns, we actually produce a different form of hemoglobin. Mm-hmm. And the CRISPR gene, the CRISPR approach was used to turn this gene back on so that you now produce this fetal hemoglobin instead of the adult variety, which, you know, causes the curvature of the red blood cells. So it's a pretty clever way to get around the problem, but it does involve a stem cell transplant, adult stem cells. These are the cells that are used to make your red blood cells. And so, you know, as you pointed out in the opener, this involves chemotherapy to get rid of your other cells and then giving you a fresh supply of your own genetically modified adult stem cells. And when it works, it looks like it works very well in greater than 90, I think they said 93 or 94% of the patients that they've studied. They don't have these pain episodes recurring.
Yep. Father, any long-term implications for this? I mean, sickle cell anemia, it sounds like it's a great, you know, use of it, but the use of gene editing technology in human treatments, is this a territory we should be dabbling in? And when is it immoral? When is it moral?
You know, the use of these types of approaches for therapeutic developments, meaning to give a therapy to somebody, doesn't raise fundamental moral concerns. I think the issues that you're mentioning or alluding to would pertain to other uses, which would be, for example, trying to enhance human capabilities. So maybe if there were some genes that you could modify that controlled the development of muscles, and you could produce super soldiers by tinkering around with human embryos, well, of course, those are not therapeutic. That's an entirely different direction that you're seeking to go to enhance human beings according to your own designs and plans. And that could and definitely would raise significant ethical concerns and objections. But these therapies that are being developed today, they really are therapies, and they're driven by sometimes very serious underlying medical conditions that will even shorten people's lives if they're not addressed in one fashion or another. So, you know, I would say this development in particular is quite hopeful and quite promising.
No, I love it. And I hope we can use this properly. And, you know, I think policymakers in the future should really consider the ethical concerns when they regulate CRISPR. I don't know how we do this. Does the medical community do it? How do we regulate this wonderful technology so that it is not abused? So, you know, how do we get them to draw that moral distinction between using it to cure disease and the you know, the tantalizing prospect of enhancement?
I think that this is a, you know, very broad question that you're raising about how does science get regulated. And I would say the main mechanism for that, Drew, at the moment pertains to funding.
Yeah.
Who's going to fund your experiments? And for the most part, it will be through governmental entities like the National Institutes of Health or the National Science Foundation. So those are the points of contact where we need to have the kind of ethical oversight so that money is not provided for unethical types of research. In other words, it does, at the end of the day, turn into a discussion about money, because once you fund something, that becomes a kind of tacit approval to forge ahead with a particular technology, even if it's an unethical one.
Right.
And we saw that with the embryonic stem cell debates, you know, over the years.
Gotcha. Well, Father, if people want to read more about CRISPR and maybe get better moral guidance, I'm assuming the National Catholic Bioethics Center has written on this and has got content that they can help guide them.
That's correct. You mentioned in the opener my column, Making Sense of Bioethics. They can check that out at our website, ncbcenter.org, or on fathertad.com. And I do have a couple of installments that deal with CRISPR and with genetic modifications of humans that, you know, touch on these themes.
It's a fascinating new frontier, that's for sure. Hey, Father, thank you. Always great to talk with you.
Well, thanks, Drew. Great to be with you.
Thanks for making time. That's Father Tapaholchek. Check out his column. I think you would enjoy it, Making Sense Out of Bioethics. And you can learn more about him simply by going to fathertad.com. That's his website, or checking out the National Catholic Bioethics Center. It's just about bottom of the hour. Maggie, do I have time for a call? Or are we out of time? No. All right. I got to take a hard break here. I'm going to be back in a moment. We'll change gears. Today, of course, is the great feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, right? And want to talk with two people about Guadalupe and the flower world prophecy. The flower world prophecy. All that and more straight ahead.
All the news and issues of the day. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, happy feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. She is the patroness of the Americas, North and South. She appeared in the geocenter of the Americas at a time when in Europe we had the Protestant Reformation raging. We were bleeding, hemorrhaging. Catholics, there was a great assault on the church. What do we have on the other side of that great ocean, the Atlantic? We have in the geocenter of the Americas one of the great Marian apparitions of the past 2,000 years. And that was Our Lady appearing to a young man named Juan Diego. And 9 million souls converted to the Catholic faith after those apparitions. You know, when the Spanish conquistadors, when they arrived in what is now Mexico, the Franciscan friars who accompanied them had a mindset in their minds, the mission of bringing the gospel to whatever people that came across. And of course, Cortez, he had more, material issues in mind. Friars wanted to bring the good news of Christ to the pagan world. For a decade, those priests, they labored, but their labors had very little fruit. There was a lot of human sacrifice in Aztec Mexico at the time. I mean, the amount of blood that was spilled. And if you ever have an opportunity, this is another great place to visit. You know, climb those pyramids. I've done that. I just think back on the incredible loss of innocent life and the false gods that they worshiped. But, you know, one of the converts of the day, and this is how God works when evil is raging, right? He raises up saints. And today we've got the great Saint Juan Diego. Very simple man. He was a peasant. Little did he know that as he walked to Mass one day in 1531, for the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, actually, that he would literally change the direction of the world itself. You know, as I said, the Franciscan friars were having a tough go of it, and their message wasn't being received well by the people. But Juan Diego had his vision of the Blessed Mother, and she gave him these flowers. I'll give you the short version of this. We'll talk much more about it a little bit later. Gave this sign that the bishop needed. He carried these beautiful flowers that the Virgin personally laid in his tilma to the Bishop Juan de Zumarraga. And those flowers then gave way to the image that we know as Our Lady of Guadalupe. The friars had the exact opposite problem. There were too few of them now to handle the people who were converting. As I said, millions wanted to come into the Catholic faith after this incredible event. Now, you might think that of all those conversions that were happening, it was because they saw the tilma, but that was not the case. The people were walking 3 and 4 days through very rough terrain in order to get to the priest who could give them baptism so their sins could be forgiven. And I think that is miraculous. But the miracles can also have a very natural basis to grow. And why these people who up until now have been resisting the gospel were suddenly coming forward, rejecting their last lives, including polygamy. They had multiple spouses, multiple wives, and they were accepting the Christian lifestyle. And it was happening in millions. The answer to that is now coming out. We thought we knew what it was, right? Oh, it's got to be the tilma. My next guests, Monique and Joseph Gonzalez, have undertaken a monumental effort. They are not PhDs, but musicians. Joseph Julian Gonzalez is a TV and film music composer. His wife, Monique, is a singer, has also worked on TV and film projects, also a music editor. But the work they put into this new book that's out, it's called Guadalupe and the Flower World Prophecy. In my eyes, it's PhD worthy work. The book is now out. You can get it at Sophia Institute Press. They're here today to share with us a little bit of their findings. Great to have you with us today, Monique, Joseph. Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm delighted to have both of you. Joseph, let me start with you. Bring us back. Can you tell us how this all started? How did this research start? And fill us in on your story and how this all began.
Well, way back in the 1990s, you know, as you said, I'm a composer, and I was inspired to set Aztec song poetry to music. So I started doing research, and I found this one book that had just been barely published in 1985. It was the first full translation of in any language of these Aztec song poems. It was written by a gentleman named John Beerhorst. So as part of my research, I had to really get into Aztec song poems. And when I got this book, the very first poem of this collection, there's about 180 known Aztec songs, and 90 of them are in this one collection called the Cantares Mexicanos. Well, anyway, I looked at the very first poem, and I was so startled because it sounded just like the Guadalupe narrative. Mm. It's about a singer who's looking for flowers so he can put them in his tilma so he could share with the lords and princes. So, as you just said, the parallels or the mirroring of the story is quite obvious. But unfortunately, in the realm of secular scholarship, the way they explain this is they say, well, obviously, this older song poem must be the source material for a fabricated Guadalupe narrative. Mm. And, you know, at that time in the early 1990s, I did a lot of research, and that's what everybody was saying. And I got to say, it really hurt my faith. And, but things changed when I met my wife in 2009. And perhaps she could give her side of the story.
Yeah, no, I'd love to hear that. So basically, just to bring us up to your point, you did this research, you lost your faith because of what you came across. People saying, this is just there's a history behind this. Monique, what did you do? You're a convert to the faith. When you read that same mm-hmm. story, you had a totally different interpretation and reaction to it.
I did. And when I read it, and then called Joseph in, and he was showing me the back of the book and what the translator was saying. I think what was going through my mind was coming from the other direction, maybe because I came into belief in God by asking a ton of questions and having God answer them. I guess I just figured, let's try and do that with this entire storyline, with the Guadalupe narrative itself, and see what happens, you know, because God is really good about that. So we started this conversation and started researching every book we can find, every paper we could find, and it eventually turned out over 14 years. We ended up with a lot of material, and after, you know, talking with different PhDs and the secular scholars, as well as speaking to every priest we could think of or that we could encounter who knew more about it than we did, it's then that we realized we have to put this down now that we see that the answer that God is giving is that instead of it being the basis of a fabricated Guadalupe hoax, maybe instead it could be God preparing the peoples of Mesoamerica over centuries and millennia for the gospel message. Wow. And that's kind of where we ended up by the end.
So you discovered a whole world of literature that was happening in Central America and what is now, of course, modern day Southwestern U.S., you know, for centuries. Mm-hmm. The literature mm-hmm. was never written down. Tell us about the flower world that the natives of the area believed in.
Nick, you want to do that?
Sure. So the flower world is basically, it's a belief system. It's a belief in a solar floral paradisal domain, which they hope to go to either after they die, but they also believe they came from before they were born, that's where they came from, and that at some point, and we'll get into it in a quick second, a storyline that it expresses this sort of this long implanted hope to go to after they died, if they were worthy of it. So basically how we know about that is secular scholars in the last 20 to 30 years, through the study of song poems is how it started, in the field of linguistics, they began noticing a lot of similarities between whether it be the Hopi or the Shoshone or the Comanche, as well as the people of Mesoamerica and the Nahua very specifically, all kept talking about this flower world paradise. Yeah. And it had the same characteristics and had the same singing flowers and radiating light emitting from the ground and from the rocks and from the air itself. And it's full of birds and butterflies. And, you know, after seeing these commonalities for so long, they finally realized that, especially one particular scholar by the name of Jane Hill wrote a paper in 1992 regarding this flower world complex is what she called it. Once she threw that out there, the scholars began running with it to see if it applied in the archaeological ruins, and they discovered that it indeed did do so.
Wow.
And so the archaeologists, especially one in particular, Carl Taub, who really broke it open, he started looking at Chichen Itza and Teotihuacan and kind of pulling open those old papers and realizing that they had all the same aspects. So now they're at the point where they just put out a book a year ago called Flower Worlds, where they're encapsulating a lot of these different papers and reinterpreting their old findings in the light of the flower world belief system and recognizing more openly that even, you know, like Teotihuacan, for instance, which is right outside Mexico City, they now believe that that's a physical rendition of the flower belief system, 100%. So it kind of changes our understanding of Mesoamerica and the Americas and is now shedding light on these ancient song poems, specifically the one that Joseph and I read, you know, earlier, but between the 1990s and 2009, between the two of us, we started realizing, oh, wow, this is reflecting a lot of these same characteristics and how can we apply that?
That's absolutely fascinating. So your efforts, your work is literally changing history, the way we interpreted history. I mean, that's pretty stunning to have archaeologists and scientists now go back and reevaluate what those cultures were like. My guests today, Monique and Joseph Gonzalez, we are talking today about Guadalupe and the world flower prophecy. I need to take a short break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more what's contained in it. And if you want to join the conversation too, you can dial in. If you're listening right now, 888-914-9149. Feel free to pull up a chair and hang out with us. Our conversation will continue with more right after this.
The Drew Mariani Show. Connected. Connected. Relevant Radio.
Hey, thanks to Deacon Frank and Creative Planning for sponsoring my show. They specialize in financial solutions that are aligned with your Catholic values. More info on Creative Planning's Catholic Focus offering, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me. Happy feast day to you. It is, of course, a feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and I'll share much more of her story coming up a little bit later in today's broadcast. There's some fascinating symbolism and really mystery locked into this garment that was given to now St. Juan Diego. Even music, and I was thinking about that during the break. I'm talking today with actually a couple who have been involved in television and film for a while. Joseph Julian Gonzalez is a TV and film music composer. So I was sharing a little while ago. His wife, Monique, is also a singer. She's been involved in projects as well. She's a music editor. But they stumbled on something. They've unlocked something that is now changing the way that we look at history, especially in Central America. There's a new book out called Guadalupe and the Flower World Prophecy. It's available now at Sophia Institute Press, and you can go to sophiainstitute.com to check it out. And, you know, we're speaking today, Monique and Joseph, I don't know who wants to pick this up, about Our Lady of Guadalupe. And, you know, within the tilma itself, there were the constellation of the night sky in 1531 when she appeared. There's a mystery as to how the image is actually on the tilma, cactus fiber that should have decayed 40 years, and it survived over half a millennium. You know, there's mysteries being unlocked now in the eye of the Virgin Mary. There's even musical notes that they've discovered in this. I'm curious about two things. One is a composer. Joseph, are you aware of the music that they found in the tilma of Our Lady of Guadalupe?
Oh yeah, we've heard about that. Unfortunately, we haven't really looked into that, so we don't know much about it, and probably I can't speak too much on it. But yes, we do know about it.
Well, I'll have to share a little bit more about it coming up. I wasn't sure how deep you were into that. So on that point, let's make the connection then to the world flower prophecy and how it connects ultimately to the Guadalupe narrative. Are these two things connected in a divine way?
Absolutely. The flower world, as Monique was explaining, you know, is in the realm of archaeology and anthropology and linguistics. But the two things that emerge from that are two transcendental aspects of it. One of them is a concept of a flower world paradise, the place where the people want to go to. But secondly, there's a concept of a flower, particularly a four-petaled flower, being a representation of the connection between heaven and earth. Essentially, it's an axis mundi. The four directions of the petals are north, south, east, and west, kind of representing the known universe or beauty that we experience on Earth. But from the center point, it's kind of like a 3D model. The center point goes up to the flower world paradise. So the metaphor here is essentially all ultimate beauty, all ultimate truth come from the flower world paradise through the flower, through the experience of beauty that we get here on Earth, beauty, truth, and goodness, okay? So the thing is that we see this in archaeological runes that actually date back to about 1500 BC. And the case that we make in our book is that God implanted these ideas so that they could essentially, excuse the pun, bloom in their proper time. And I'm sure we're going to go into this, but these two transcendental concepts play prominently in the flower song poems, which eventually will lead us to the Guadalupe narrative and make the connections for the indigenous people.
Wow, absolutely amazing. We saw millions convert as a result of it too, didn't we? So it wasn't so much the Tilma as much as it was this flower world that really brought about a radical transformation. I never knew about that. This is all new to me today, to be honest with you.
Well, we don't in any way discount the Tilma. We say that it's part of a kind of a network of artistic ideas. They express the Nahua people. These are the people of Mesoamerica at the time of the conquest. They express divine ideas, divine concepts through artistic medium. And of course, that is also expressed through the Tilma. But what we're trying to say right now is that the Tilma is the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole philosophical basis. There's a whole other world of information that we are
and
saying.
A story.
Yeah, and a story that actually lay the foundation to truly understanding what happened with the Nahua people, what God was trying to do, how he was trying to communicate and make a case for belief. And so that's actually the hypothesis of our book. So we can go. Hopefully, we'll have time to show you some of these connections. But
I only have a few minutes for you. So let me. I don't know which one of you would like to take it, but why don't you make a couple of those connections and then maybe offer some final thoughts?
Okay, Minnie.
Well, sure. Well, in the Guadalupe narrative itself, when Juan Diego was passing the hill at Tepeyac, he immediately responds upon being surrounded by all this music by saying, "Am I worthy of what I hear?" Which is a very strange comment to make, first and foremost, and we'll explain in a second. But he also says right after that, "Am I in the place my ancient ancestors spoke of, the flower world paradise?" In Xochitlalpan and Tonacatlalpan, in the land of heaven. So with his very first words, he's connecting himself to this ancient belief system. And also with what he said, am I worthy? He's piggybacking off of the very end. We didn't get to go into the earlier song poem. But in the end of that earlier song poem, the singer is crying out because he wasn't able to actually possess the flowers to put in his stomach. He thought he did, but it didn't actually happen. And he says, "It's because I'm worthless and afflicted, and I sin on earth, but the God of far and near can make one worthy to go there." So when Juan Diego comes in the beginning of the Guadalupe story, and he says, "Am I worthy of what I hear? And could I be in that ancient flower, this ancient flower world paradise?" He's, in a sense, finishing a story that was never finished in the ancient pagan world, because as a baptized Christian, he's actually able to go there. And so within a few moments of him saying that, Our Lady steps forward and says, I am the mother of the god of far and near in Tolkienawake, which in the earlier song poem, the earlier song poem actually says the god of far and near is the only one, is the only one who can make one worthy to go to the flower world paradise. So when Our Lady comes in the Guadalupe story and says, I'm the mother of the god of far and near in Tolkienawake, she is also tying to that earlier song poem and giving an answer that to the ancient quest to go to the flower world paradise by saying that now it's possible to go there because the god of far and near is now present, or Jesus Christ, who the ancient peoples had maybe an intimation of, is actually entering into the picture. And because Juan Diego is baptized and has committed his life to Christianity, he's now able to possess those ancient flowers of heaven.
That's right. It's amazing how God works, isn't it? You know, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
When you look back and how even centuries later now, we're coming to learn and understand this. I just think it's fantastic. I know you unpack all this in your book, don't you? So let me,
Guadalupe and the flower.
I have about a moment left. So let me give you, Joseph, some final thoughts as well.
Well, what we're trying to say is that, you know, God laid out breadcrumbs. God laid out a foundation which could be fulfilled once the true story, once the fulfillment of Jesus Christ comes into the timeline. And that's what exactly came here. He provided by the expiation of sin through his sacrifice. He is the God of far and near in Tolkienawake, which is an attribute of God, not a pagan deity or anything like that. But he actually opens up the possibility of eternity, not only to the Nahua people, but of course to the people today who want to accept Christian, who want to accept Jesus Christ, and who want to go to spend eternity with their creator. So we're basically saying that the desires, the cravings of the heart, what we see in these monuments, is also available to us today, and it's speaking to us today that if God was doing that for the ancient Mesoamerican people, why couldn't he be doing it today, even in these turbulent times?
I love it. Well, thank you so much for what you're doing. Your book, if people want to get it, is that the best way to get it, Sophia Institute Press?
That's the best way because you're supporting their Catholic apostolate. Of course, it's also available on Kindle or Amazon or Barnes & Noble, any other bookseller.
That sounds great. Hey, thank you both. I hope you have a wonderful feast day. I know a lot of grace is coming your way. Wish we had more time. We could certainly. I know there's so much more to unpack. Try to compress it in such a small window.
Yes.
But we'll do that another time. All right?
Okay. Sure.
Okay, thank you. Really God bless you.
Really, thank you, Drew. Really thank you so much. God bless you.
Appreciate what you do. And Joseph, we'll have to catch up. I want to talk to you about music. All right? It'd be great to do that. It is just 2 minutes now before the top of the hour, and I have to take a very short break here, too. If you want to join us, the number's 888-914-9149. By the way, that book, Guadalupe and the Flower World Prophecy. Guadalupe and the Flower World Prophecy. It's available from sophiainstitute.com. That is the website for it. I'll have to have them back. We'll certainly want to talk to them in greater detail about their book, and of course, certainly want to pray for you. So if you want to get in, let me open the phones right now. It's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149, and I'll take your calls and your intentions, really, your prayers. You can also hit Maggie up right now if you'd like to. She is on X. Just send her a tweet, at Drew Mariani Show, at Drew Mariani Show, and Maggie, do we have some stuff we can talk to them about on the other side today, or do we want to wait on that? You know what I was talking to you about in my office? Yay, nay? We'll wait. Okay. Got something with Maggie and I want to talk to you guys about coming up, but we'll pray today. All right? And that's straight ahead. So stay with us. You can also send me your answer prayers. Maybe I'll share a few of those as well. Drew@relevantradio.com. As those miracles unfold in your life, send them to me. Okay? Drew@relevantradio.com. The Chapel of the Divine Mercy is straight ahead on a wonderful day, right? Great feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe.